Dr. William F. Tanner is Distinguished Regents Professor of Geology at Florida State University. That's in Tallahassee, where Steve Bowden's daddy coaches. He is also a devoted Christian layman and a man of faith. Today, in his address, he undoubtedly will show us how those two identities coagulate. His subject will have to do with time, and I look forward to his uncovering several naked enigmas as he speaks to us. Dr. Tanner.
Thank you, Dr. Coleman. This is obviously an intelligent audience this morning. You are here on a Thursday, and that takes a bit of doing. I'm glad you didn't laugh too loud. That might indicate that you doubted what I said. I'm going to take advantage of one of your official clocks this morning, not the one that I wear, but one that you have in one of the rooms over here. All three hands are moving backwards. I've accused the seminary of all sorts of things in putting that clock in the room where the speaker is supposed to sit and relax for a moment or two before he comes in here. But I note that according to that clock, it is now 20 minutes of 9 and is getting earlier, which gives me plenty of time. I remember as a child hearing a preacher once tell a joke about how much time he had, and I've forgotten the joke, but I remember very clearly my impressions from it. The point of the joke was that in view of the conditions that he was citing, he could speak for 3 or 4 hours if he wished, and as a child I sat there afraid that he would. What kind of equipment do you use for telling time? I'll share with any of you later a look at my cheap watch. It cost less than $20, much more than 20 years ago, something like 27 or 28 years ago. I'm way ahead of the game at about 75 cents a year. Some of you are more sophisticated than that. Some people use cheap equipment like this. And this one happens to have 4 hands, and if you study the hands, they go the right way. If you study the hands carefully, you can read hours and minutes from them. Some of you probably have quartz-controlled watches with LED or liquid crystal display, and you make a nuisance of yourselves by always reading the time when you're asked to a hundredth of a second. I have in my laboratory in Tallahassee something called a nanosecond timer. With this instrument, I can measure units of time much smaller than a millionth of a second. Try that one on your watch. I use it to measure the speed at which shock waves travel through small rock specimens, so that I can get away from fracture effects. The elapsed time that I measure may be 20 or so nanoseconds. That's billionths of a second, 20 billionths of a second. I'm using time units like that. Don't care to carry it around with me, it's about so big. All of this equipment, clocks, watches, timers, laboratory timers, only approximates the measurement of time. In the case of an electric clock which you plug into the house circuit, you have a degree of accuracy which is provided by the electricity In the United States, it is supposed to be 60 cycles per second. In some other countries, it is not that. If you plug in your electric clock in those places, you get weird results. But this control is provided by another piece of equipment somewhere else, and I don't know that it is accurate. It might be, up to a point. We have three basic units of time, and two of them are spelled out by our planet, the planet on which we live. Some people have called our planet the clock on which we live, and there's a great deal of truth in that because of our three units, two of them are measured by our planet. But it's a very poor clock. Our longest unit of time is the year. This is the amount of time necessary for the Earth to go around the sun once. And how do you know when you get back where you started? Well, we use the configuration of the stars, the patterns of the constellations, to tell us when we're back at the starting place, and we measure a year in that fashion. This works very well for short intervals, such as your lifetime and mine, but not all of the stars are traveling in the same direction, and not all of them are traveling at the same speed. And if you come back in a few thousand years, you will not recognize the constellations in the sky. The signposts will be different. For the time being, we have no basic unit of time any longer than the year. We assume that it is constant in length. What are you going to check it against? And therefore, we use multiples like decades and centuries, and we think there's no major error there. Our intermediate unit of time is the day. This is the amount of time needed for the Earth to spin on its own axis. The word day has many valid definitions. Some of them span intervals greater than 100 years. Let me give you an example. In the day of the Egyptian pharaohs, there were no automobiles. How long was that day? For our purposes, we will define the day as having 24 hours. When we use the word day to mean weeks or months or years, or decades, or generations, as in the example I just gave you. You can plug anybody's name into that, you know. In Julius Caesar's day, there was none of this or that. When we use the word day for long periods of time like that, or for short periods of time like a working day with 8 hours, or I read in the paper the other day, some union in New York City got a 5-hour working day, they call that a day. These are very loose definitions, very loose. They're all right. It's part of English, but it's not a precise definition of a time unit. As a precise unit of time, a day contains 24 hours, doesn't it? It is then convenient to subdivide it into hours, minutes, and seconds, but not a one of these is a basic unit of time. From the point of view of subdividing the day, from that point of view, I wish to give you another point of view in a moment, but from that point of view, there are 86,400 seconds in a day, and up until very recently, that was the definition of a second. So a second is a derived unit. It's not basic at all. I said a moment ago that the year may be a constant. We think it is. We cannot say that for the day. It's 24 hours, but it's not a constant. In fact, we have a great deal of evidence to show that the day is slowly changing its value. The change, fortunately for us and for our watches and our clocks, is slow enough that it does not bother us in a human lifetime, but it is extremely important, and this becomes obvious as we take a look at the expanses of the past. A day is one revolution of the Earth on its own axis, turning on its own axis, and we mark this by daylight and dawn, don't we? But the earth is slowing down as it revolves. There is friction in the system, and the earth is slowing down because of the gravitational pull of the sun and the various planets that are reasonably close to us. Every rotating body in the system is slowing down as it rotates. The moon has gone completely through this history and always presents one face to the earth. That is, it turns on its own axis once while it goes around the earth once, so that its rotation and its revolution are equal on the moon. The earth is in that process and hasn't gotten to that stage yet, but we're headed for it. The planet Mercury has reached that stage, and on the planet Mercury, one day is 1 year long. One Mercury day is one Mercury year long. That's 88 days by our standards. Mercury, like the moon, always has one face looking at its primary. One side of Mercury always looks at the sun, the other is heated to the maximum, the other side always looks out in empty space and is cold. As the earth continues to slow down, day gets longer. It will eventually reach the condition where it turns on its axis only once a year. One face will always look toward the sun. That side will be unbearably hot. The other face will always look outward away from the sun and will not be illuminated, not by the sun. And that side will always be extremely cold. All of this means that the day cannot be constant in length. It's a rubber sheet day and keeps changing its character. That's a pretty sorry standard, isn't it? This slowing down has two parts. If it were long-term and consistent, it might not bother us too much, but it has some jiggles on it, and sometimes the day gets shorter for a little while, and then it suddenly gets longer again, and so it is an erratic business. But in the long term, it's slowing down. The rate at which the earth is slowing down, and you can all breathe easy, is two additional seconds are added to the day every 100,000 years. You can reset your watch. 2 seconds are added to the day every 100,000 years. Now, it is customary for a person who learns that for the first time to shrug and say, okay, it's negligible. Why are you wasting your time talking about it? It turns out that it is not negligible. Over the expanse of geological time, this is a tremendously important change. This is 20 seconds every million years. Doesn't sound too much yet, does it? And 20,000 seconds every billion years. But 20,000 seconds is 5.5 hours. 5.5 hours, a billion years from now, that much longer for the day. This indicates that the year 1 billion years ago, I'm sorry, the day 1 billion years ago was 5.5 hours shorter than it is now. A day having 18.5 modern hours in it. And if you had been born, you'd have a tough time then because there's no oxygen in the air. But if you'd been born then, it would strike you that a day was a day, and you might argue with all the stuff I'm talking about right now. But if you go in a time machine back to 1 billion years ago, you would be very much aware of the fact that the day was very short and the night was very short. Farther back into time, the day was shorter still. 4 billion years ago, which is not back to the origin yet, the day apparently was only about 2 hours long. So you could work like mad for an hour and then sleep like mad for an hour, and that's all you had. And back before that, it must have been shorter still. There are some fossil corals, which Dr. Moody will appreciate, I feel sure, from Devonian age rocks, which he will appreciate also, which show daily growth lines. A tiny bit is added to the cup per day, and they also show annual growth bands. That is, they grow better in the warm part of the year than in the cooler part of the year. In Devonian time, there are 400, statistically, there are 400 daily growth lines per annual growth band, 400 days in the year. If I do a little arithmetic, this gives me a day having 21.9 hours in it, in the Devonian. And Dr. Moody took me over across the river and showed me the Silurian. Silurian fossils over there, that's even older than this. So the day was a little shorter than this. Unfortunately, we did not get to go back to Silurian time. We would have run out of time if we had, because the day was markedly shorter than it is now. If we spread all of that change over the time in between, we discover that the day has been growing longer by 2 seconds every 100,000 years. That is, we get the same result that I quoted for you a moment ago, and we got that result from modern astronomical observations. So we now have come at it from two different sides using two completely different methods and have gotten the same result. We observe that the day is not constant. It's a pretty sorry unit of time. After the universe was created, but before the earth was created, the day did not exist. We've had the year and the day. Our smallest unit of time is the second. Basic unit of time is a second. We've changed that in the last few years. We modified it. We used to divide the day into whatever number I gave you a minute ago and come up with a second. Now, the smallest unit of time is one vibration of a hydrogen atom. We've redefined the second in terms of how many times the hydrogen atom vibrates and say, well, when it vibrates enough time, that makes a second. This is called atomic time. The day and the year are astronomic time. This is atomic time. An atomic clock, which uses the vibration of hydrogen atoms, measures time so precisely that it can maintain a precision of 1 second for 50 million years. The basic unit, of course, is really smaller than that, but it's not convenient to use it, and so we recast it in terms of the second. And now we've got a problem because the second is no longer defined as a fraction of the day, and as the day gets longer, then something funny is going to have to be done with the second. There's also radioactivity time. This has many units. No one of them can be shown to be basic. Each radioactive element decays at its own distinctive rate, and so what we do is translate radioactivity measurements or radiometric measurements into years. These translations are made as of right now. By right now in the scientific literature, they mean 1950. With the radioactivity time, looking at time millions of billions of years ago, who cares whether it's 1950 or 1980? So 1950 is the official peg for radioactivity time. At some future date, as the length of the day changes, we will have to redefine some of our units because they won't come out right. And I'll let some future generation worry about that. I don't think we'll have any time, any problem redefining the year because as far as we know, it is constant. If you wish to argue it is not constant, then you are introducing the hocus-pocus element. And then anything goes. Okay, we have astronomic time that include the day and the year. We have atomic time, that's the modern definition of the second based on atomic time, and we have radioactivity time. Those three. We observe that the day is variable in length. It's a very bad unit. And so the relationship between the astronomic units, day and year, is changing all the time. Atomic time is highly precise, 1 second in 50 million years, but we cannot use it to measure the past. It measures only now. Radioactivity time can be used for measuring the past, but we cannot use it for any practical purpose for measuring the present. For For long intervals of time in the past, radioactivity measurements translated into years give us our best procedure and our only procedure. But the system is extremely complicated, and it contains a few fluttering duck items like the day, which will not hold still for us. It doesn't even decrease at a regular rate, except statistically. Okay, I've covered a lot of ground here, and I've done that in order so that in the next few minutes you cannot say that I didn't say all of that. I want to draw three important conclusions at this point, and then we'll come back and look at some things in detail. Number one, the day and all of its subdivisions and the year are limited to the Earth. That's how we defined them, wasn't it? It's something that the Earth does. That doesn't hold anywhere else. An observer on Mars cannot keep Earth time unless he keeps in radio contact with the Earth, and then he can't keep it precisely because there's a radio transmission lag which varies from time to time. Earth time's not worth a thing on Mars. On Mars right now, the day is 24 hours and 37 and 4/10 minutes long. And the year, Earth hours. And the year on Mars in Earth days is 687 days. Now, I tell you all of that, not that you need to know the numbers. I couldn't care less whether you know the numbers or not, but that you will understand that Earth time applies only on the Earth and nowhere else. Each planet has its own year and its own day. And with one exception, the value of the day is changing. It is getting longer. On Mercury, the story is complete and it's not slowing down anymore. All of this information tells us that the units of astronomic time are local and temporary. They don't apply anywhere else or any other moment in time. They're good only for here and now. Number two, the units of time vary as time passes. Discussed that some already earlier. Number three, since the modern units of Earth time cannot be used throughout time and space, they certainly cannot be applied at the origin of the solar system. We have no good, useful, constant, universal measure of time. Does that bother you? No, it doesn't really bother you. It's of academic interest. But the scientist must think about it, and the theologian could and should think about it. From a practical day-to-day standpoint, we will continue to use sundials or hourglasses, whatever it is you care to class, and just like we've been doing all along. But when we think about the origins of the system, we must remember that these words don't mean anything except here and now. How long was the day when the universe was created? That's a silly question. There weren't any days. The Bible says that a day with the Lord is like. Most important word in there is like. A day with the Lord is like 1,000 years. I've heard some people say that that means a day is equal to 1,000 years. I fail to see that. A day is like 1,000 years. I take this statement to mean that you and I don't understand what a day with the Lord is really like. And so it's been couched in language that ought to disturb us but doesn't enlighten us very much. A day with the Lord is like 1,000 years. In other words, you and I don't know what a day with the Lord is like. And it might as well be 1,000 years because we don't comprehend that. From a scientific point of view, we have no conception of it because we have no absolute unit of time, nothing. No faint hint. Days and years are convenient, but they're just local and temporary. Suppose you could put in a radio phone call to a person, a creature, a dweller on a planet close to a distant star, and I shared with you earlier this week that if you find a planet circling the nearest star Just the first two statements, one by you and one by your friend, will take 8 years to complete. Okay, you've got plenty of patience. Would you like to talk to him about the time? You have no way of doing that because you and he, even if he speaks English, his words for time units, whatever they may be, have nothing to do with any word or time unit that you may have. And you can't talk to him at all. We can measure time, as I've indicated, as long as we can put a timepiece of some kind, a measuring device, on the body that we wish to use. But if we don't have a suitable measuring device, then what we're talking about is subjective time. I've discussed astronomic time and radioactivity time and atomic time, and we must include subjective time. It's not the same as any of the others, and in fact, you cannot measure it. There's no way in this world you can measure subjective time. Let me give you a good illustration. The lecture is over, and two people are queried outside by a third, and the third says, I left my watch home today. How long did the lecture last? And one of them who came in the right mood said, well, it was really good. It was only about 4 or 5 minutes. And the other one said, no, it seemed more like 4 or 5 hours. Subjective time. And that sort of thing happens all of the time. Once we strip away the confusion that's caused by subjective time, and that causes a tremendous amount of confusion for us, we still have a major problem. It is instinctive, I suppose, to think that surely at the bottom of all this tangle of spaghetti, there has to be a basic unit of some kind, and if we just dig deeply enough, we'd find it. There is no hint of any such unit. In 1972, an important experiment was reported in the scientific literature, and you're going to have to take my word for some of this. In this experiment, the investigator made 2 round-the-world trips on commercial jet aircraft. They fly fast enough to start to make it interesting. One trip was taken eastward, all the way around the world, and not very many days later, another trip was taken westward, all the way around the world. It's rough on the investigator, but that's what he did. He took 6 atomic clocks with him. This is to give him replication, which is necessary in science. On the eastward trip, these 6 clocks lost an average of 59 nanoseconds. Now, you'll never tell that on your watch, but it's tremendously important. This is serious for an atomic clock. This is a terrible error for an atomic clock. On the westbound trip, the average error was a gain of 273 nanoseconds, and that's still less than a millionth of a second. That's high precision, isn't it? And yet it's terrible for atomic time. The important thing here is that the error, we thought it was an error. I mean you and I, not the investigator. He knew what he was doing. The apparent error that we have here, the type of error, is related to the speed of travel, and in fact, the numerical results are related to the speed of travel. What we are seeing here appears to be a demonstration of a theoretical concept that we trace back to Einstein, that the passage of time depends in a very real way on the velocity of the instrument. Wow. There is not even an absolute instrument. Everything in the universe is moving. The Earth moves as it turns on its axis, 1,650 kilometers an hour, 1,000 miles an hour. It's faster than you can fly in a commercial jet by quite a bit. It also moves in its orbit. 107,000, 107,30, 107,000 kilometers per hour, 30 kilometers per second. The entire solar system has a velocity within our part of the galaxy. The galaxy itself is turning, and in addition to that, is moving through space. And you and I are on a corkscrew path at unbelievable velocities through space, how could we possibly have an absolute measure of time? Some other stars are traveling faster than our own, much faster. Apparently, time is a function of the velocity of the instrument, and the velocity depends on the location within the universe, and this is in addition to all of the early complications that I discussed for you. Therefore, atomic time does not provide us with anything fundamental. According to the best available theory, time speeds up in a weak gravity field and slows down near a very massive object. The gravity field is not uniform throughout the universe. So this last observation adds another reason for thinking that there are no absolutes in measuring time. We measure time here and now with very great precision. We obtain by radiometric means the duration of time. We translate that into local modern units, don't we? Years. Since an important geological event somewhere back in the past. But we cannot extrapolate our time to anywhere else in time or space. That's very disconcerting, isn't it? The only absolute that we have, apparently, is that time passes. And perhaps it passes in one direction. I want to draw 7 inferences from this. What I've tried to do in the last few minutes is to make you uneasy with time. And I want to draw 7 inferences from this. Number 1, God created it. I don't know of any verse in the Bible that says that. Can you believe something that's not in the Bible? I think God created it. Number 2, the statement that the evening and the morning were the first day must mean that God was marking time in some way. But there are not any words in any earthly language to describe those units of time. And so he used, or the writer of Genesis used, the very flexible word day. Even though that unit, with its official present definition, was meaningless at that time. That's not a case of God misleading us, but of God trying to communicate us through our own thick skulls. That is, time passes. And in the absence of a standardized unit, the word day is a perfectly good word. What would you prefer? Not any of them are any better. Number 3, time does not apply to us in the same way that it applies to God. Perhaps it does not apply to God at all, I don't know. But it does not apply to us in the same way that it applies to God. Number 4, for us time moves inexorably. We cannot slow it, and we cannot speed it. Only in subjective time can we change the rate at which it passes. And if you check your watch, you find out what a mistake you have made. This does not mean that the rate of passage of time is constant. All this means is that you and I don't control it. Can God control it? Well, the answer to that depends on what you want to believe. Number 5, time is allocated to us in quantities which we cannot measure. On the other hand, I do not believe that it is issued to God in a limited quantity. If that's true, then somebody else is the storekeeper. The concept of eternity, which we find so frequently in the Bible, is basically a statement, I think, that God has access to unlimited time. I used to think as a child that time was like a long freight train. This comes from sitting at the crossing and seeing some long freight trains go by. And that if we would just sit and be patient long enough, that we would finally have the caboose. I've changed my mind about that. Time is not like a long freight train or a bus on a long bus ride. I think God has access to unlimited time. I don't know what that means, but I think he has it. But you and I can neither increase nor decrease the amount of time allocated to us. Jesus said that by taking thought we cannot add anything, and I prefer to read that, to our lifespans. I don't know very many people, maybe on the basketball team, but outside that I don't know very many people who would like to add 18 inches to his height, but I know lots of people who would like to add 18 years to their ages. But no matter how hard we think about it, no matter how hard we pray about it, we cannot add to the amount of time that's available to us. I think of the story of the rich fool and the parable by Jesus who misjudged by a factor of some 3,000 or 5,000. That's a pretty bad error. How much time he had left. What did he say? He looked over all of his loving cups and trophies and medals and bank accounts and everything else and said, oh boy, it's going to be great for the next 20 or 30 years. And God said, thou fool, there is a committee which is looking for you tonight. And he actually had less than 24 hours. Each one of us always lives on the brink of termination. We may estimate based on some observations, but our estimates are commonly wrong. My mother was one of 10 children. One of the sisters was very frail. The others were all in good health. 9 of them are now dead. Only the frail sister is still alive. And this year she celebrates her 103rd birthday. Our estimates are commonly wrong. We have no information about the amount of time allocated to us, except in a few trivial cases like watching a person jump off of a 100-story building. He has 7.5 seconds. We can control to a large extent the quality of time. But we have, other than taking a few precautions like staying out of in front of buses, no control over the quantity. This dichotomy, quality versus quantity, that's fascinating for me. Which would you rather have? Seriously, which would you rather have? $100 of genuine U.S. currency, whatever that happens to be at the moment, or $1,000,000 of play money? Millions more than 100. Which would you rather have? A real home and a small, very humble house in which it is located, or a pen and ink sketch of a castle? I think most of us would choose quality rather than quantity. Isn't it interesting that God gives us control over the quality and we can't touch the quantity? Number 6. I'm still in a list of 7. Number 6. God expects an accounting of where and how and why we use the time that he has allocated to us. This accounting can be done in some small measure here and now. Each thoughtful Christian should undertake this exercise from time to time. If you really get into it, you might call that prayer. But the primary accounting will be done later. Some of us may have a mental picture of a judgment in which each person will be called to stand before the great judge on the great white throne, and a bailiff, perhaps an angel, will read from a book in which all of the brownie points and all of the demerits have been recorded. I'd like to take a step at least away from that. I'll not argue that it's beyond that, but at least away from that. There is no book except for you yourself. You are the book. There is no bailiff except for you yourself. You are the bailiff. And you will be called to be ready to read that record with all of its flaws, not the way you wish they were recorded, but the way they actually were recorded. You will be completely honest in that moment. Even the atheists will be honest at that time. You will be surprised to learn that some of the things that you thought were victories were really defeats, and some of the things that you thought were defeats were really victories. Even in this life, we sometimes are allowed to see that. But there will be no reading. For each one of us will know instantly what he did with the quality of time. Fortunately, we don't have to wait until then. We can examine the quality of time now. Number 7. God is the creator and the master of space and time. That's an article of faith on my part, isn't it? I bring you nothing from the world of science that says anything remotely close to that. But I believe it. This must mean, among other things, that he can move freely in the four-dimensional framework of space and time, whatever all that means. He is not constrained by space. He is not constrained by time. He is not constrained by energy. He himself must be able to see all of time simultaneously. You have a little sign in the room over here next to the phone book that says it will not be permitted for one person to make 3 calls on this telephone simultaneously. I want to be there when somebody tries it. I've heard about busy executives who are working with 3 phones at once. I have a hard time keeping track of one. I think maybe the best statement of all that we can make here is that God is present simultaneously in all moments of time. That's an article of faith on my part. Statement of this should be a source, whether you agree with me or not, should be a source of a great deal of awe. Even if you disagree with me, perhaps you will improve your own insight at this point. This should be the source of a great deal of awe. It also contains another matter that I think is important. If what I've said so far is correct, then I must say the following. At the moment of death, a soul can be carried through time by the hand of God to some other moment in time without a delay. That is, when Stephen died, he could be carried by God instantly without a delay of any kind to the resurrection experience. No purgatory, no imprisonment, no way station, no waiting room, no eternity of sleep. Surely a soul, not talking about a body, surely a soul does not sleep. And Paul's language must be figurative. Sleep is a biological function, despite the propensity of some Christians to try to make it a spiritual function. What does the wide awake soul do after death? In an effort to explain that, we have invented purgatory. But God is the creator, the owner, and the director of time. He's the executive director and the resident manager. And I believe that he can transport his child from the death experience instantly to the resurrection experience. Where is my mother, who is dead? Where is my father, who is dead, my earthly father? I think that's a meaningless question. They were here with me. They were taken without delay to the resurrection. Do I get that out of my scientific background? Of course not. I do not wish to use Stephen's vision as evidence of this. He did make a statement on the subject, you know. I don't want to use that as evidence. I've had the good or bad fortune of being so close to death that it was too late to argue about it. I was dead and I knew it on several occasions, 2 that come to mind clearly. In one case, the fatal event, the one that killed me, only it didn't quite, took about a second and a half. I'm sure from having been there that it lasted 4 hours, subjective time. And I know some of the things that a person thinks during that time, subjective time. I don't wish to use any of that as evidence. I wish to base my argument on the simple assumption that God is free to move through, to occupy, to overstep time. Back at the beginning, we started this talk with something about the precision of your watch, and if you've got a cheap one like mine, it gains or loses a minute or so every day. Not any of them are very good. All of them. Your most expensive ones are bad. They're good enough for our daily use. But even the clock on which we live, our planet Earth, does not keep time carefully. Maybe it marks the year accurately, but the rest of it's very bad. Precision, fortunately, is not important. You don't look at your watch to see what time it is anyhow. You look at your watch to see what time it isn't. And precision doesn't matter at that point. Time is more important than the measurement of time. It moves inexorably. It varies in rate from one part of the universe to another and from one part of history to another. It cannot be reversed, and each one of us has an unknown bucket full of it. All we can control is what we put into that bucket. As we think about time, we get into some concepts that are far more important than timepieces and timekeeping. And maybe we get a little closer to understanding something about how God operates. This insight might be included in something we could call the doctrine of time. This doctrine is not stated explicitly in the Bible, but it is implicit in much that has been given to us in the Bible. Today I've tried to explore in a very feeble beginning way some of the implications of the doctrine of time. The most important thing that we can say about the doctrine of time is that God has given us the privilege of controlling the quality, but not the quantity, of time. Thank you.